Greetings, and welcome to the Thinking About What Comes Next, an Economic and Market Update with Jim Allworth conference call. During the presentation, all participants will be in a listen-only mode. If at any time during the conference you need to reach an operator, please press star zero. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded Thursday, May 21st, 2020. I'd now like to turn the conference over to Peter Fullerton. Please go ahead.
Thanks, Jennifer. Welcome, everyone, to our Royal Bank Plaza branch conference call this afternoon. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Fullerton, the Vice President and Branch Manager, and I'm joined today by Cam Sievert, the Assistant Branch Manager, and Jim Allworth, our main speaker. It's my pleasure to introduce Jim. Jim has been with the investment business since 1968. That's over five decades as both a research analyst and portfolio strategist. Much of that time, Jim spent with us at RBC Dominion Securities, where he developed investment policy for the firm and translated that into solutions for individual clients. As an investment strategist, Allworth utilizes RBC's extensive global economic, political, and sector analysis to develop a strategic view on major financial markets. Jim co-chairs the RBC Global Portfolio Advisory Committee, which provides strategic analysis of financial markets and establishes the asset allocation mix for our clients worldwide. He regularly contributes to the RBC Global Insight Monthly publication, which is available to all of you at your request. Today, Jim will provide us with a market overview for the first part of the call, and then Cam and I will ask Jim several timely questions that we're hearing from our clients. Jim, thanks. Over to you.
Thanks, Peter, and welcome to everyone. And I just will apologize in advance. Like everyone, I'm at home, and I have two dogs here who frequently disagree with my view on the market and sometimes let that be known, so you may be hearing from them. Well, I think the word that kind of vibrates with me constantly out here is uncertainty, and for a long time, massive uncertainty. So some of that seems to have ebbed, but every time some part of the story seems to become less urgent, something else takes its place. That's probably going to be the case for a while. It's worth reminding ourselves, I think, how fast things have changed and how fast they can continue to change. It wasn't very long ago, as we entered the year in January and right through to the middle of February, that the COVID virus to everyone here in North America and in Europe looked like a problem for the Chinese, but not much of a problem for anybody else. To the extent it was a concern, it was worries that the Chinese economy, which at that time had shut down, was going to affect supply chains into North America and into Europe, and that might produce something of a slowdown, but there was really very little contemplation that somehow or other this would become a direct impact on our economies. By the middle of February, that was about to change, and it changed in literally a matter of days. And as people started to understand the implications of shutting the economy down and the idea of social distancing and washing your hands moving into something more restrictive, it seemed that there was an open-ended downside to this for the economy and for markets. And while markets sometimes like a wall of worry to climb, they don't like a wall this steep and this big. And people started walking away from financial assets and stocks in particular, sending the market into a real tailspin, which featured a fair bit of panic selling along the way. Eventually, the market regained its composure, if you can put it that way, stabilized for a bit and has rallied since and has gained back a little bit, right around 60% of what it gave up. And meanwhile, the economic news has deepened and worsened in many respects. To some extent, we're taking some comfort from the fact that the pandemic seems to be following the trajectory that we thought it would, and that I'd say, in all fairness, a great many people thought it would. Once you acknowledge that it was here, you were also faced with the fact that it was going to surge in numbers and that you would get some high numbers that were very unsettling. But our sense was that it would peak sometime in April, and we'd start to see the number of daily cases decline, and that would go on through May and June and into the summer. And the further those new cases declined, the more active the conversation would be about removing some of the social restrictions and commercial restrictions and trying to get the economy reopened. It also, the abruptness of all this and the speed with which it arrived and the implications of how bad it could be stimulated response from governments and from central banks. We had huge intervention on the part of the Federal Reserve and other central banks around the world, including the Bank of Canada, designed to try to head off a credit crisis and a credit crunch. And it seems that they've done that. They've pulled out all the stops, but it's worked. Credit markets are functioning. You can buy and sell bonds. The Fed is buying almost every kind of debt there is. If the market won't support it, they will. And that's removed one of the risks and one of the factors that typically turns recessions deeper and longer than they otherwise would be. So that's very good news. And, of course, government has stepped up and put in massive fiscal stimulus to try and make sure that as many people stayed employed as possible, that companies got over the valley and the jobs would still be there when that was done and that income would be continued along the way. All those things have helped. Our view is that, first of all, I said the pandemic seems to be following that trajectory I laid out. If there's any change to it at all, it's that our friends south of the border started talking a lot earlier than anybody was comfortable with the idea of reopening the economy, and he kept putting lines in the sand, which he eventually had to cross, but he dug a deep line in the sand in early May and has talked it up, and you get into a situation where once three or four or five states have decided that they are in the position to reopen, if you're a neighboring state, it becomes very hard for your politicians not to follow suit. And so there's been a bit of a bandwagon effect. Two or three weeks ago, almost no one was talking about reopening, and suddenly many states are embracing plans and have actually to reopen and have actually reopened in some respect with more to come. And probably faster than people realize. And I think that bandwagon effect extends across the border. So if the U.S. auto industry is going to open up in the next couple of weeks, and that's the word that it is, then I think it's going to be very hard for Queen's Park and for Ottawa to say we won't participate. We're so connected to that industry, it seems that if they're open, we're going to be open. More and more, there's this impetus on this side of the line to get things started, if only partially, but at least to get them started and feel our way forward on this. So to continue with where we thought things would go, our view was that the worst of this would be the second quarter, the quarter we're in now, that would be the period of the maximum dislocation. And I know that a couple of months ago, in saying that to my colleagues, that was our view, that the second quarter would be the worst, I also made my own sense of it was that knowing that the second quarter was going to be bad was not nearly the same as living through the second quarter when it was really bad. And I think that is true. I think it's one thing to pick up the paper and see speculation about job loss, it's another to hear the reporting on it. And I certainly don't intend to be a media basher. The media has to report the news, and they report what they view as newsworthy. And usually, the bigger the impact, and in some ways, the more negative, the more newsworthy, and that's what we're hearing. And that isn't going to end anytime soon. We will be hearing for a long time, perhaps even after we've left much of this behind, about about who still has been left behind by it, who's been impacted by it fatally, how unfair some of this is for certain segments. All these things are going to be part of the dialogue for some time to come. But we think we are going to get past it, and we think the third quarter, beginning in July, will start to be somewhat better. And the numbers still won't make wonderful reading, but they'll make better reading than the second quarter. And we'll see maybe an even greater momentum build in the fourth quarter of the year and extend on through 2021. If you need, in order to feel better, if you need the economy to be back to where it was when this all began, that isn't going to happen much before the end of 2021, possibly not even until early 2022. Or if you have a higher standard and you need this, the economy to be back where it would have been if this hadn't happened and the economy had continued to grow at the rate it was growing at before, that's not going to happen much before the end of 2022. But if what you need is that the economy quarter on quarter can start to show improvement, we think that that will be starting to some degree in the third quarter and much more definitively in the fourth. It is worth reminding ourselves what history teaches us in all this. So whenever I turn on the radio or read a paper, or an article, there are a whole bunch of phrases that jump out at you at the same time. And one of them is that we're in uncharted waters and the world will never be the same and things of that tenor. And I guess my only observation is I could have said that every day when I got up and be right. It is always different. And sometimes the dislocation can be larger than others. But in some sense, of course, it's going to be different and changed by this. But in some sense, history would suggest it isn't, that the economy will get past this faster than you and I will get past it psychologically. We can look back to more than 100 years of pandemics, of world wars, of wars that perhaps weren't world wars but still important and a huge challenge for the people embroiled in them. Nuclear disasters, financial crises, and probably the list has a few other things in it as well. And when you look at them, you find that when they were over, they were over. That none of them cast an extremely long shadow on the economy. That within a year or so of them being over, the economy was back growing at a kind of long-term potential rate. That it typically sustained, and that it was being driven by the things that drive that long-term growth, which are the growth in global population and the growth in prosperity and the growth in productivity. And we have no reason to believe this time is going to be any different. If you look back to the Spanish flu, which followed on the heels of World War I, Spanish flu was deadly. It killed 40 million people worldwide at a time the population was only a fraction of what it is today. 40 million people killed worldwide, and the people it killed were predominantly adults between the ages of 20 and 50, which is not the profile today of the mortality. This was following on the heels of World War I, which had killed the exact same age group, only the youngest part of it, in the tens of millions as well. And you could have looked at that huge death toll and been forgiven if what you said was, you know, this we're losing a generation here, as people did actually, and the economy will take a generation to recover. And that was just wrong. A year and a half later, the economy was growing and growing quite robustly. So I could go through each of the dislocating events of the last 100 years, and you would see that the same was always true. Even the Depression itself, which lingers in people's minds, actually had a growth component to it that nobody remembers. And I'll give this to you very briefly, but the crash of 29 led to the the decline of the economy and the drop off of the economy for the next 2.5 years. In people's minds, what happened was that the economy collapsed and stayed collapsed all through the 30s, the dirty 30s. To continue the lore is that somehow or other it was only brought back to life by the arrival of World War II and the necessity to step up production. And yet, if you look at it historically, you find a very different picture. Yes, the economy collapsed right through into 1932-33. But after that, it grew very, very rapidly under the stimulus of lower interest rates and government stimulus that propelled growth to extraordinary rates. So the growth rate in 1934 was 16%. The growth rate in 1935 was 10%. The growth rate the year after was 12%. The growth rate the year after that was 9%. And in fact, it would have continued on growing, except that the U.S. government was so upset by the deficits that it had run to try and bring the economy back to life that it put a tax increase in 1937 that was so large that it killed the economy again and sent it back into the ditch and sent the market back into the ditch. But, you know, the economy didn't stay depressed after 1937. It rebounded and had been growing rapidly long before the war started. So most of the lore about the Depression is incorrect. For our purposes today, the economy was on its way about a year after hitting bottom. But let me make a distinction. There's a difference between whether the event casts a long shadow on the economy, which it doesn't, or whether it casts a long shadow on people's psychology, which it does. Many people carried the hardships of the Depression with them for the rest of their lives. Many people were so dislocated by the financial crisis of 2008-2009 that they found it very hard to do anything but look over their shoulder for the next 4 or 5 years after that, worrying that there had been some sort of message buried in the financial crisis that was telling them even worse things were to come shortly thereafter, and thereby miss a good part of the longest economic expansion in history and the longest bull market in history, which followed the financial crisis. We don't know when the event we're in now will be over. We think it'll go the way I've described. But what we're pretty sure of is that when we get a year past the worst that can be done here, that the economy will be growing again. This matters a lot when you start thinking about markets and how you'd value businesses. And there is a question, well, let's put it this way. It is a fact of life that worry and concern about the short term makes it very hard for people to focus on what matters, which is the long term. The long term is highly predictable. The short term is almost completely unpredictable. People are concerned about the short term here in an intense way. And when you do that, when that happens, you lose sight of what is there in the long term. But if you think about buying a business, if you're tomorrow going to go out and buy a business, or if you're going to buy shares in a business, or if you're going to buy the market, which is an aggregation of highly successful companies, what you are really buying and what you should judge the price of it on is the long-term profitability of that business. The profits it's going to return to you year after year, off into the future, for as long as you own it. So the price you should pay should be equal to this year's earnings plus next year's earnings plus the year after's earnings and so on out for usually decades. And you should add all those earnings up and then discount them back by an appropriate cost of money, and that's the fair value to pay for that business. Well, when you think of it that way, that the value of a business is made up of this year's earnings, next year's, and so on, you could blow up this year's earnings and maybe a good part of next year's earnings. And in reality, you haven't put that big a dent in the long-term value of that business. And when we do that exercise, looking at, say, the S&P 500 or the TSX, we have to make very dire assumptions about the future of the economy beyond the next year or two. In order to justify a 15% permanent decline in the value of businesses. And in fact, if we use our own forecast, which is that this year's earnings are pretty awful and next year's earnings are better, but still not back to par, and only in 2022 do we start to get back in stride, which builds from there on, when we look at it that way, it looks to us as though the cost of the COVID virus is probably something in the neighborhood of 5%. Well, at the worst moment of panic selling, this market was down 35%. We think that was kind of overdone. It's rebounded. It's confusing people as it rebounds. So people say, how can the economy be so bad and the market keep going up? And if you went back and looked at the bear market lows of the last 50 years, what you would find is that usually the market is moving up before the recession ends. In other words, you go through a period of months, sometimes quarters, when the market is rising, but the economy is still in recession and the news is still bad. That's very typical. And when that's happening, that means usually that earnings are continuing to shrink, even as prices are going up, which means PE multiples are rising, and that just doesn't seem to make sense, and that's the sort of question always posed out there. Are investors crazy? Why are they paying these prices? And they are, in some sense, able to look forward and are assessing the long-term prospects for that business and decide that they can pay that price. Our approach here is to look at both these things and say we have a lot of confidence in the long-term value of businesses. We also understand that we're still in a period where there's a lot of uncertainty and where things can come out at us in left field in the short run and maybe put more fear into investors and make a market more volatile again as it was a few weeks ago. That's certainly possible. I can think of lots of things that people aren't thinking about now that might come home and give people pause. And so our approach to this is to have a recommendation that says portfolios should probably be underweight equities. In other words, if there was a percentage in a portfolio you'd normally have committed to equities, we'd be content if we were somewhere below that. That leaves us still with exposure to equity markets, but we're not fully exposed or overexposed. But we're inclined to think the longer this goes on where share prices have been remain under pressure to a certain extent because of these short-term events, that we should be looking for opportunities over the course of the next months and quarters to add to positions in great businesses that we think are going to do well in the coming years. We're not going to be perfect on that, and no one is. No one's going to pick the bottom and no one's going to pick the top, but you can lean against risks when they're inappropriately high and you can lean towards risk when they're worth taking. And the correction in the market and what's going on in the economy is starting to push things in favor of taking risks that are appropriate. We aren't there yet, but we think that's the next chapter and going to open to up to us over the course of the summer and the fall. There are a lot of things that we could touch on here, and in some ways I can respond to them in questions. But let me maybe anticipate a couple of those. One of them that I'm asked frequently is, are you concerned about the amount of debt that governments are taking on here? And the answer is not especially. I could imagine the long term where some of this debt becomes problematic, but in the short run, I'm not. Most governments are capable of servicing this debt. Ours is. It's maybe somehow or other, we carry around preconceived ideas, but one of the ideas we don't carry around and should have is that we were actually in great shape going into this. We had at the federal level, and a lot of provinces were in pretty good shape too, but at the federal level, the only country that had a better debt to GDP ratio than our own was Germany. Now, going into this in good shape is one thing. Blowing the doors off with the kind of stimulus everyone's put out certainly changes that picture. But we're not the only one doing it. Everyone's doing it. So it isn't a question of somehow or other being able to point fingers at us and saying we're profligate and then people selling our currency and giving us all kinds of grief. Absolutely everybody is doing something in the same vein. I'm not concerned about the debt in the short run. I think the interest rates also are so low that the debt servicing cost remains extraordinarily low even when you pile the debt on. There are issues in the future, though, and one of those issues is that is phrased this way. Isn't all this debt really just printing money, and when you print money, don't you get inflation? And the answer to that is possibly, but not for sure. And I think the way to think about it is to use the framework that Milton Friedman popularized, and he said that inflation was always a case of too much money chasing too few goods. And so if we've been printing money here, maybe at the rate we have, maybe we've got too much money. But is it chasing too few goods? And I would say no, there's a surplus of goods. There's a surplus of productive capacity around the world. It's going to take a long time to eat through it. We're not going to get to that point where there is too much money chasing too few goods, probably for at least 2 years and maybe three or four. So while we might get some inflation out the other end of this, I don't think it's a problem in the near term at all. It's worth remembering that the same things were said after the financial crisis when we'd had what looked like money printing going on, and we had quantitative easing, which everyone insisted on calling money printing, but which I would argue often wasn't. But let's say I was wrong on that. Let's say it was money printing. People questioned for several years after the financial crisis ended that maybe all that money printing was going to produce inflation. In fact, many of them didn't say maybe. They said it definitely was going to, and you and I know that there was virtually no inflation except for about two quarters in 10 years of any consequence at all. And so I'm not sitting here worrying about it this minute either, but I am kind of writing down in my diary that maybe a year and a half from now I should go back and look at this again and see whether we're starting to run out of excess productive capacity, and if we are, is there a danger of inflation at that point? And there may well be, but right now it's not an issue. And the last thing I'll mention is oil, since it matters to certainly people in Alberta and BC and Saskatchewan and everyone else in terms of cost of doing business. And oil has been hugely volatile in all this and compounded the problems for us. We had a price war between Russia and Saudi Arabia, which Saudi Arabia responded to by raising their production rate substantially. The world was awash with too much oil, and just at the exact same moment they were doing that, the COVID crisis hit, and miles driven and the consumption of gasoline fell through the floor in virtually every economy. And fortunately, Russia and OPEC came to their senses, if you like, and they made a huge production cut, which was too late in one sense because there's already too much oil out there on ships and in tanks around, and that's kept prices down. But what it did do is forestall a buildup in inventories over 6 or 8 months that would then take 3 or 4 years to run down and would keep prices depressed. So we have a near-term problem, but even that is going away faster than expected because production in many places is dropping. Production in the U.S. is down by close to 2 million barrels a day with more to come. Production everywhere besides OPEC is down, and then Saudi Arabia came out the other day and chipped in another 1 million barrel a day cut. And at the same time, China, who very often do this, whose economy is back running, whose traffic is much more up at normal levels, walked into the market when prices were extraordinarily low and bought huge amounts of oil, which is now being delivered to them at rock-bottom prices. So we think oil is past its bottom, probably has further to go. Does it have enough further to go to fix the problems in the Canadian oil patch? And our view is probably no. It can stabilize it for some, but some are still, even at $30 and $40 oil, which is where we think we'll be over the next year or two, it is not high enough to rekindle what Alberta in particular needs, which is the development of new oil production. They need high prices to do that, and high prices, we think, are a ways off. And we need them on more than a spike basis. We need them up at a level where people are pretty well convinced they're going to stay at those sorts of levels for a long period of time, which would justify the billions of dollars of new expenditure to produce high-cost oil. And we think that's not something you and I should be waiting for in the next few weeks. This is something that may take some time before we get to that level. So without trying to anticipate every question, Peter and Cam, could I turn it back to you? And if you had some questions that have come in, I'd be happy to respond to them.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. You did a great job of anticipating a bunch of the questions, certainly regarding the debt and inflation and the situation with the oil. But maybe you could just speak a bit. Are there any takeaways you're seeing on how economies, overall government policies have been evolving as this pandemic situation sort of wears on?
Well, I don't think they've evolved too much. That is to say, I think they just decided they were prepared to move cash out into places that if they didn't put a cash buffer in would change things much for the worse, and they've done that. And they've done it differently. You know, the amounts are very similar, but the terms aren't always the same. Some are making loans that have to be paid back. Others are basically just putting the cash out there and saying, you know, do what you want with it and you don't have to pay us back. Or if you do, it's on extremely favorable terms and over a very long period. All those things can be debated. But I think essentially it's all hands to the wheel and get out the buckets and send the money out. As soon as you see something that's doing anything that might freeze up the gears, go out and pour money on it to release it. The $64 question out there is how well this works and how do you reopen? And just telling businesses they can reopen and telling people they should go back to work doesn't necessarily make it so, which makes it a somewhat different picture than in China where in fact, you can kind of demand it. And even in China, where there was a lot of pressure to do it, you still see that people are reluctant. So we have people who watch a lot of things electronically, and you can watch the traffic in major cities. And when you do that, you saw that when China shut down, the traffic in cities like Shanghai and Beijing fell by, the traffic congestion indexes fell by 80% to 90%. And that subsequently happened in New York and all the major cities in the U.S. and Toronto and London and so on. Then China reopened, and in a matter of weeks, the traffic congestion went back up to normal levels on weekdays from Monday to Friday when people were going to work. And part of that was just the people who were going to work, and part of it was that people who were going to work decided not to go on rapid transit. They went by car. So it brought traffic congestion back fairly quickly. But on weekends, there was no congestion. People were not driving normal amounts on weekends. They were staying home and being cautious. And that has only started to change in China in the last few weeks. And we expect we're going to see the same sort of thing here, and we already are. So restaurants might get the permission to open, but the ones that I talk to could open conceivably in the next week, but are thinking it's probably the end of June before they do. And one of the things that has to happen is that somebody has to go out there and do it. And then when people start to see how it works and how it operates and whether it can be done successfully, there'll be more and more taking it on because they don't want to lose business indefinitely. So I think it's going to be three steps forward, two steps back for a while. And I don't think, other than pouring more money on it, that there's more policy imagination that's going to surface between now and then.
Thanks, Jim. Another question here. What indicators or signposts are you looking for to sort of give us comfort that things are we've seen the worst and that things are getting better over the next few months?
Well, there's a couple, and I'll mention one that I think is already giving us a positive signal, and that's the so-called shape of the yield curve, which is the gap between short-term interest rates and long-term interest rates. And that gap got a lot of press last year because it inverted. In other words, we went into a period that lasted for 2 months when short-term interest rates were higher than long-term interest rates, which is abnormal. That's not usually the case. And it usually indicates that credit conditions have started to tighten up in a way that is going to bring a weaker economy down the road. Well, we know that the weakness in the economy, the profound weakness in the economy, came from COVID. But if that hadn't happened, the yield curve inverting last August and September would have said that the economy probably would have been in recession by the fourth quarter anyway. It's worth noting that the inversion of the yield curve, as happened last year, has always been correct. In other words, a recession has always followed that. And while the time gap between the inversion and the recession actually starting can vary, it has averaged about 14 months and has been an awfully reliable indicator that a recession was coming. And it showed that last year. From our standpoint, we paid attention to it, but we had several other indicators we watched as well, and they were kind of hanging in there to some degree. So we became more cautious and more vigilant, but we weren't outright bearish, and then COVID caught us, like everyone else, flat-footed, if you like. The yield curve has another great virtue in that by moving the other way, it forecasts accurately that a recovery is coming. So when short-term interest rates fall back below long-term interest rates and stay down there, that has always told you that a recovery was coming in the economy. And on average, it was about 11 months later. Well, that happened last October, suggesting if that 11-month gap holds, that the recession would be over by September of this year. Which isn't kind of too far off our view, which is it's probably the fourth quarter when you'd say recession was over. Now, this could be the first time. There can always be a first time that the yield curve won't be correct. Or it may take longer than 11 months this time, and it has in a number of times taken longer than that. But I'm inclined to believe, and I think believe is the right word, that the yield curve is correct and that we are going to have a recovery, and it's probably going to start late this year and at the latest early next year. So I feel that, to me, is a reassuring data point. Another one that I will be watching will be the ISM indexes, both for the manufacturing economy and the non-manufacturing economy. And ISM stands for Institute of Supply Management. Essentially, these are the indexes that get reported every month, and when they're above 50, they indicate that sector is growing, and when they're below 50, they indicate it's contracting, which would be consistent with recession, and they've fallen to extraordinarily low levels, but the latest iteration of them shows them moving higher, not back to that 50 level that would say the economy is actually growing, but it's sinking less quickly, if you like, according to these things. We'll watch those closely, and if they start to get back closer to 50 level, especially a couple of components in them, in particular new orders, then that would also give me a sense that the yield curve again was going to be right and that by later in the year would be out of recession. So those are definitely ones to watch. And the last that I'd mention is the Conference Board, which puts out something called the Leading Indicator, it has 10 different factors that it measures, and it's, of course, fallen out of bed and has been headed straight down. And when it turns up for a couple of months running, usually it indicates that you're past the worst and on your way to recovery, and I'll be watching for that too. So all those things we can look at. If what you need is the idea that the unemployment rate is coming down or that unemployment insurance claims are dropping like a rock, what you find is that you'll be waiting beyond the end of the recession. Usually the unemployment rate doesn't peak till several months, maybe even a couple of quarters after the recession ends, which puts you again in one of these unusual positions where the economy is actually doing better and is out of recession, but unemployment continues to rise, and people keep saying at that time, how can that happen? Well, it always happens that way. And then finally, the unemployment rate rolls over, and over the course of the next number of years, moves lower and lower and lower. That though, is a lagging indicator in this case, and it hasn't. It's nowhere near turning yet that we can see.
Thanks, Jim. One of the ones we've been hearing lately is there's still a lot of commentators, you know, that think the overall market may, you know, retest the lows that we saw in March. You may have to look into your crystal ball for this one, but do you see that happening, or what are your thoughts on that?
It wouldn't be unusual. Historically, when you have panicky lows, probably a majority of the times when you have a panicky low, you go back and revisit that low before the market gets going again, and sometimes you break below that low. So you can't rule it out. Like I said, it's a majority of times, but there's also certainly times when that hasn't happened. And if you had asked me a week after the market bottomed, I would have said the odds favor it retesting the lows. The longer this goes on and the better the market behaves, the less likely that is. That is to say, the market has behaved well. It isn't just a few stocks going up. It's lots of stocks going up. The majority of stocks have been going up. So there aren't sort of things in the nature of this rebound that say this is, you know, you're not looking at this correctly. Most things are really weak. It's just a handful of big cap companies that are coming back and doing well. That isn't the case. And some of the strongest performance has actually been out of small cap companies, oddly enough. Even on days sometimes when the market's down, small caps are up. That indicates really broad participation, which would argue that we're in, you know, a new advance. So I would say if we get a retest of the lows, it's because there is going to be something that blows out of left field that people have not thought about that really raises concerns and issues for people. And very often those things come out of the credit market. And that's going to be hard to do here because we've got central banks that are essentially supporting the credit market. But to give you an idea, and I don't mean to suggest these are the things that are going to happen, but let me just blue sky here for a moment. You know, Italy is the country that was most devastated by the COVID virus. It was a huge hotspot. It had gigantic problems. It had to close down big parts of the economy geographically, which were its most productive parts in the north, and really has paid a price for it. And Italy is an economy that hadn't been performing that well since the financial crisis ended. It's also got more debt than in terms of debt to GDP than any country in Europe except Greece. This shutting its economy down for months here, although it is looking in much better shape now, makes you wonder whether people are going to be worried about Italian debt. And in fact, the spread on Italian debt versus German debt has widened over the course of this. And if we get into some period where suddenly markets just don't want to buy Italian debt and Italy has to try and refinance some of its existing loans and can't do it, then, you know, that's the kind of thing that would catch investors' attention and make them worry that central bank support was going to collapse and so on. Or you could come across the pond here and look at a place like Mexico. And oil is an important part of the Mexican economy. And tourism is an important part of the Mexican economy. And both of them are in the penalty box in a big way. And Mexican debt, Mexican interest rates have, vis-a-vis American interest rates, have blown out here. If you woke up in a couple of months and had a story out there that Mexico was going to have to default, that would be another thing. So that, you know, I don't think if you've been talking with your friends about the economy, that you've been talking about Mexican debt or Italian debt, but they're the kinds of things that could be the unintended mine, if you like, in the minefield that came up and gave the market pause again. I had a good friend and colleague out here who's no longer with us, but his favorite phrase when we were in periods of economic distress or market distress was, there's never just one cockroach. That you know, other things come out from behind the woodwork that are driven out by the other weakness around them, and that might give you problems. And those things could happen. Even if they do, it's our expectation that the long term will reassert itself. And so, as usual, we're highly uncertain about the near term. And we're highly certain and confident about the long term, and it is always the problem of investing to kind of get past the short term and figure out how to best take advantage of the long term.
Thanks, Jim. That was very insightful and rational in this somewhat irrational environment we're in. It's always good to hear someone with a common sense, reasonable approach to what's going on in the world. We really appreciate your time, and we really appreciate everyone who's joined us on this call, your time. We're here for you. We have an abundance of material from Jim, both videos that Jim consistently produces that we can send off, as well as his material. And we really encourage all of you to reach out to us anytime, and we can get that material to you and or answer any questions you have. I'd like to thank everyone again, and have a good evening, and that ends our call today. Thank you.
That does conclude the conference call for today. We thank you for your participation and ask that you please disconnect your line.